Greeting and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forums and your host for today. We welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker and his interviewer. Our speaker tonight is Ashley Vance, who is the author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. He is a columnist for Bloomberg Businessweek and a tech writer. He was born in South Africa, and he is based in Palo Alto. He will be interviewed by Katie Fehrenbach of Fortune magazine. Without further ado, Elon Musk and Katie. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Ashley Vance.
Yeah, there we go.
I wish I was Elon. I have so much money.
That was a Freudian slip right there. All right. So I'm pretty excited to interview Ashley. I met him several years ago on a bus in Oregon up at the Facebook data center. Of course, I've read the book, pored over the book, loved it, learned a ton. So I'm pretty excited to ask him these questions today. So just to kick this off, so Ashley spent, what, 2.5, 3 years, over 300 interviews on the book.
Should I? Oh, it's back here. Which way should I? Screw it.
This way.
Sorry.
Sorry about that. All right, so you spent almost 3 years of your life on this book. What was the point when you decided or realized that you wanted to write about Elon Musk and spend all this time focused on him?
Well, I guess, I mean, I kind of committed to the book pretty early on in the process. I was not really a big Elon fan. I'd been in Silicon Valley reporting on all kinds of technology companies for a long time. Elon had been, he seemed like a guy who was always promising the world and taking an awful long time to deliver it, and things seemed very expensive when they came out and not to work that well, and so I was kind of skeptical. And then, you know, in 2012, everything kind of changed for me. SpaceX went to the ISS, Tesla came out with the Model S, and SolarCity went public all in the span of about 2 or 3 months. And, you know, I just thought, here's this guy who's been talking about this stuff for so long. He's just done a run that I think you could argue nobody in history has kind of equaled the breadth of what he had tackled in that span of time. And so I did a cover story on him for Business Week magazine, and I went to the Tesla factory, and I liked that, and then I went to the SpaceX factory, and then I thought, okay, this is kind of the coolest thing I've ever seen. It's in the middle of Los Angeles. I expected there to be one rocket being worked on, and there were dozens of them and thousands of people, and then Elon was way more interesting than I had sort of thought. I'd pegged him as kind of like a one-note techno-utopian kind of guy cut from that cloth. And, you know, he turned out to be a great interview. He seemed to, like, authentically answer your questions. He didn't have a bunch of people around him. He was just very accessible. And so I'd been looking for a book to do, and I've always been into manufacturing for some reason. And so I knew sort of that was the moment. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah, and so there's been a few books written about him, but this is the first one where you've had such in-depth access to him and his friends and his family. How did you convince him, or what was it about you that you think he agreed to collaborate with you? Or maybe not collaborate, but
do interviews. Yeah, I mean, still not totally sure. You know, I went to him, I said, I want to do a book, and he said, people have asked me before, and no, and that was kind of right after I'd done the cover story. And then a couple months went by, and I sold the book anyway in New York, and I sort of thought if I sold the book, that would force his hand, and he would collaborate, and then that turned out really badly when he said no. and so then I kind of didn't know what I was going to do. I mean, I knew I could do some kind of book. I thought it obviously wouldn't be as good without sort of him in there, but I just kept going for about 18 months. I interviewed a couple hundred people. A lot of those people would call back to Elon and ask if they should speak to me or just tell him what was going on. And I think that happened enough that one day I was just at my house. It was like 6:30 in the evening, and on the caller ID, it just said Elon Musk on there. And so picked up the phone. He said, look, you know, I'm either going to be a real jerk to you and sort of make life really hard on you, or I might cooperate with the book now. And I was like, well, let's do option B. You know, option what? A sounds terrible. And so we went to dinner. I mean, I think, you know, I think it was just a matter of he knew other people had asked before and he'd told them no and they had stopped. And I think I just kept going. And Elon likes the press. I think at that point he knew a book was going to happen and that he would sort of do himself a disservice if he didn't talk. And so that was it.
So persistent.
Yeah, I mean, Elon, if there's anything Elon is, it's persistent. You know, I mean, as I was doing these interviews, all these people would be like, well, Elon never takes no for an answer. You know, and I was like, well, then I'm not going to take no for an answer. And then, I remember our first dinner. I mean, I think that he's like, look, I thought you were going to give up. You're still doing this damn thing. Let's talk about whether I'll cooperate or not. I mean, I know that persistence was at least part of it. Yeah.
What was it like to spend, however, 50-plus hours with him, just like on a personal level? What is he like?
Well, the first three interviews, I mean, it was kind of frustrating because he was sort of like he always is. I mean, he would, like, answer your questions, and he was engaged, but it didn't feel like I was getting anywhere new. I was hearing a lot of stories that were the same. And I'm like, man, I finally get Elon Musk, and this is going to be terrible. I'm not going to have anything fresh in the book. It was like a curse at that point. And then all of a sudden, like in the fourth interview, I felt like he decided to cooperate, but it was kind of in the fourth interview where he really, like, mentally said, okay, this is happening. Now I'm going to.
Was it something in particular that broke him open, or just got used to you?
Like, it was an off-the-record thing, so I can't tell you exactly what it was, but I had found out some stuff about this guy at NASA who Elon knew really well. And so I had gotten sort of like a juicy backstory on something, and Elon didn't know the politics. Like, he thought he knew the politics, but he didn't know this part. And so then I think he was kind of like, okay, now we're kind of trading information a little bit. And he also seemed to like that I kind of had gone, I think, that far where I was kind of learning. Because I'd already done so many interviews that I wasn't, it's like starting from scratch, kind of, where were you born and all that stuff. And so I could see it on his face. He totally changed, and he loosened up. And that interview went like 4 or 5 hours. We closed the restaurant. And then from then on, I mean, it really was. Like, we did one interview a month for several months, and that would be like my favorite day of the month, not because it was just like I'm going to talk to Elon, but it was always really engaging, and you started to think after a while, like, this guy could be the first guy on Mars, and I'm just sitting here like having ribs with him. It's kind of strange, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think you've told me before that, you know, he's one person with kind of everybody else, and then he's a very private person with, you know, friends, very close friends and family. Do you feel like you were able to kind of see that side of him, or even through interviews with his family members?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was like some weird layer that was being invented as this went along, because, I mean, Elon is he compartmentalizes so much stuff in his life. There's, like, one thing I just found that was crazy was that there's people that have worked with him for 12 or 13 years, and they, I mean, these are like high-up SpaceX executives, for example. I mean, they have been through these tremendous highs and lows with Elon. They talk to him almost every day for 12 years. I mean, and he, none of them considered Elon really their friend. Elon, I'm pretty sure, does not consider them his friend. I mean, it's a strange, so you're kind of compartmentalized. You're at work, you know, and then there's kind of a group of friends that are another layer in, but then there's the really close friends. There's probably about five of those, and I think they see a different side. And then his family is quite close too. So I felt like we were definitely never friends, but I was the annoying reporter guy who had hung around long enough to kind of get a little deeper.
Yeah. What surprised you the most during your reporting? I mean, was it some of the things like that Google was interested in buying them at that one point, and you got that scoop out of that? Was it something like that, or was it something more emotional?
I mean, there were like newsy nuggets. When I found out that Google almost bought Tesla, I distinctly remember that moment. But I mean, the biggest surprising story for me was really SpaceX and kind of it's like the most, it should not exist as a company. It's the most unlikely sort of thing. I mean, you've got entire nations that have spent decades and billions of dollars building these things, and this guy comes along who was like an internet millionaire who really doesn't know what he's doing. He's reading rocket textbooks to sort of figure this out, and the people he assembles are very smart, but they're smart and young and energetic, but they were not like a seasoned crew of people who had built rockets before. I mean, there were a couple who knew like engines really well, but no one who had done anything like this. And then they end up on this island, Kwajalein, in the Pacific. You know, it's like Gilligan's Island of rocketry, and this goes on for years, and it actually works. And then they start out as kind of a joke in the aerospace industry, and then, you know, by now they have like completely revolutionized. They'll put everybody kind of on notice, and all these companies have had to change. So I think like when I started hearing these stories about Kwajalein and these guys building their own plumbing and barbecues and stuff on this island while they're making rockets, it's like too good to be true.
So it's kind of how threadbare and stretched the company was originally.
I mean, I've written like a lot of company profiles for the New York Times and Business Week and the Economist. I mean, there's just nothing like the story. I mean, not only what they went through, but sort of what they were trying. The scale of everything was just crazy. You know, I mean, they're trying to go up against the Russians. it just shouldn't happen. Yeah.
Yeah. What was the most difficult part to report out?
That's a good question. Well, it was mostly like dealing with Elon would have been the biggest challenge. There's lots of highs and lows. Even when he cooperated, I felt like he was going to turn off the faucet at a moment. After the first interview, we would email kind of constantly.
In terms of parts of your story reporting him, what were like the most difficult things? You know, because there's some very personal things that you delve into. You know, his childhood, his father, the death of his first child, things like that.
I mean, well, his father is the biggest push button issue for either Elon or anyone in his family, and I could never. It's sort of unsatisfying because I never fully figured out kind of what went on with him and his dad. You know, there were about five times when Elon sort of was like, this is what happened, and he would cut himself off, and he would actually start crying, and he would then he would just be like, you know, it was fine. And then his brother did the same thing. He was about to tell me sort of this grand story, and then he stopped and said, you have to ask Elon, and just kind of repeated a bunch of times. So whatever it was, it definitely left a mark.
And it's interesting, it's kind of not a common story, but a lot of the big, innovative entrepreneurs out of Silicon Valley, not a lot, but there's some very famous ones that have expressed very difficult childhoods. And I'll ask Quentin Hardy's question, you know, do you think that these kind of difficult upbringings and constant desire to kind of leave a mark and better yourself, you think this is kind of at the heart of these types of entrepreneurs that are trying to change the world?
Yeah, it's kind of tricky because you have guys like, I feel like, Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg on one side who seem to have really healthy upbringings and wonderful family lives and everything at their disposal. And then you have kind of Elon and Larry Ellison and Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos, kind of the more or less like abandoned or had a really tough time with one of your parents. You know, I think like in Elon's case, I don't think you have to be a great psychologist to kind of see that there were, you know, his childhood had this clear effect on his life. Yeah, the rough time with his dad, he was a complete loner as a kid. I mean, he had like no friends that I could find at all outside of his family. And then when he wasn't being kind of ignored by people, he was being bullied really badly, like kicked down a flight of stairs in hospital for a couple weeks. And I think you know, it's so funny when you talk to these people that he went to school with. They said he was like the least likely person they would have ever thought would do any of this stuff, because he was not exceptional in any way at all. And I think his life has been a quest to prove that he's exceptional.
One of the really interesting parts of the book is, since you kind of laid out his whole story, was you could really see the evolution in aspects of his character. And one of those was his management style. You know, he's kind of well known for being, you know, pretty abrasive and combative in certain some circumstances, but then being very beloved and having this very loyal base of employees. But I thought it was interesting when, particularly with PayPal, you know, he seemed like he evolved dramatically between kind of PayPal and like running Tesla and SpaceX nowadays. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's like a really good observation. I mean, like, people sort of forget that he did. How many people in here are sort of like Elon fans, or is this all the so, you know, before he did SpaceX and Tesla and all that, he did a couple internet startups, Zip2 and PayPal, where he was the founder, he was the largest shareholder, he was the CEO, and he was basically kicked out in a coup at both companies. I mean, mostly because he was really unbearable to work with, and you know, he seemed the last one when he's at PayPal one day, and he decides to have like his first vacation in a long time. It's a honeymoon with his wife, and they had waited like a year and a half to have it. And they take off in the plane, and they're going to the Sydney Olympics. And the second the plane takes off, all the company convenes a meeting to kick him out as CEO. And by the time he lands, they like deliver him this phone call and tell him that. And I think at that point, that left like a real mark on him. I think he, you know, he would kind of berate people in meetings to the point that they left like completely devastated and their morale was low. And I think, you know, he started to figure out that he just couldn't do that anymore. It was like very conscious. I mean, Justine, his first wife, told me, he came home one day and was like, I have to learn how to, you know, treat people better and work on that. And I think he did work on it over a few years.
Yeah, it's getting in the way of him doing what he wants to be doing. Interesting. And then, you know, he's evolved in his management style, but also in his kind of stature or celebrity. Also, obviously, because his companies have done so well, but just in the way he kind of presents himself. You know, from the beginning, you kind of described him as this like awkward, sometimes awkward guy. You know, talking about addressing his employees and in not exactly the most professional way. To, you know, going to a Tesla event where he's wearing like snazzy jacket and like the crowd is cheering. So he's kind of this cult of personality has kind of grown over the years. I mean, do you see points without in your narrative of where, you know, he really emerged with that type of persona?
I mean, I think it's really grown. I mean, I think in Silicon Valley, he's been kind of this celebrity of sorts for a while. I think it's like 2012 when Tesla really hits it big that I think Elon starts to feel like a celebrity more. And I don't think he loves all of it, but he certainly revels in a lot of it and enjoys being kind of the Tony. He enjoys this whole Tony Stark sort of comparison. And you see him like enjoying it more and more now. But I think, yeah, I mean, I feel like once he had sort of Tesla was the real deal, I think that set him on this course. Kind of something that was almost, it is kind of a consumer hit, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think someone told me once that, you know, Elon Musk has this massive appetite for risk, one of the things that sets him apart. You know, I'm sure he talked about, you know, all that risk that he brought on himself through those years. I mean, did you think that he kind of, how do you think he deals with things like that? I mean, did he talk about that aspect of his life? You know, like, I was surprised when you talked about, you know, how stressed out he was, because I kind of had pictured this person who just kind of lets this massive risk drift off his, you know, off his back. Yeah. But you talked a lot about how, you know, how he stays up late at night. Like, how does he deal with these things?
I mean, everyone said it was, he said, everybody else said it was his childhood that sort of prepared him for this. I mean, he seems to kind of enjoy suffering. It's strange. He, you know, there's this part in 2008 where all of his companies are collapsing. He's getting a divorce. His wife is, like, blogging about it all the time, which doesn't help. And, you know, he gets this new girlfriend, Tallulah Riley, and when they're asleep at night, he's having these nightmares. He's crawling all over. I mean, he certainly, you know, he like, feels the stress of the moment, but he seems to kind of, like, revel in making rational decisions in the face of all that stuff and takes pride in that. And then he certainly has, like, I don't know where it comes from, but he has a higher tolerance for risk, I think, than anyone. You know, if you, he made about $220 million from PayPal, and, you know, I think I say in the book, short of creating, like, a actual money-destroying machine, you could not have picked worse companies to go into than an electric car company, a, you know, rocket company, and a solar company. And he did burn through all that money. I mean, I would doubt that, like, anyone in this room would be willing to lose $220 million.
Yeah. Do you have insight into that thought process that makes him different? I mean, you talked about first principles in your book, and a lot of people have talked about how he has kind of the design thinking, you know, and he's an engineer. Do you have insight into kind of what makes his thinking different than other people?
I just think he's brutally logical and rational. I mean, I sort of make an argument at the in the end of the book that he's like this clinical term, which is profoundly gifted, and it's kind of a group of people that at a very young age they see kind of like a flaw in the world that needs to be fixed. And I think for Elon, you know, it was this humanity is kind of in peril. I can do something about this. I'm going to do it. And I think like it all kind of comes from this crazy rational place. And I think it's hard for other people to sort of interact with how focused and logical he is.
Yeah. And you started writing about it in this kind of height of his positive narrative arc. I mean, how much risk do you think has been removed, though, from these companies? Do you, when you look at Tesla, SpaceX, SolarCity, I mean, do you see, you know, more risk or more downturns in his companies? And, like, what do you expect to happen?
I think there's still tons of risk. I mean, I think at the end of the new book, he's talking about Tesla, and for people who don't know, I mean, Tesla now, they've had sort of a successful car, but they're building this huge battery factory in Nevada, and he's essentially spending, like, all of Tesla's money, even money that it doesn't have, billions of dollars, on this factory, and this factory has to start producing batteries more or less the second Tesla is ready to produce this third generation car that they have coming, which they expect to have huge demand. And, you know, Elon says in the book that, like, if one of these factories sits idle for a month on either side, you know, it could bankrupt the company easily because they're so massive and expensive. And then, you know, SpaceX just had a rocket blow up, which is really bad after a string of success. And, you know, if they had one or two more, certainly if they had a rocket blow up with somebody in it, that would be terrible. I think, to me, you know, SpaceX is going to be the harder company for competitors to match. I feel like it started with this clean sheet of paper. Tesla started with a clean sheet of paper as well and has used that to its advantage. But SpaceX is so in contrast to these other companies who have spent decades kind of doing their business a certain way. And SpaceX is so far from the way they do it. And its prices are so low that, you know, it would take radical changes from these other companies to stick with it. So SpaceX can get back to being consistent. I mean, I think it's actually, oddly, the least risky of his companies.
Right. Well, even though, you know, they just had an explosion a couple weeks ago. Yeah. So what did Elon Musk think about the book? I mean, on Twitter, he publicly, you know, was kind of pushing back on particularly one quote about his management style. But in general, what do you think he thinks?
Well, he's so originally Elon wanted to be able to put footnotes in the book, and he wanted to read it before it came out and everything, and I did not let him do that. But I did let him. I let him see the book before, so he didn't have to buy it on Amazon. I gave it to him like 2 weeks before it came out, and I could have seen him too. He would like order it and then speed read it as quickly as he could. But so, you know, he read it, and he, in this very Elon way, he started at 3:30 in the morning, according to the timestamp on his email, and every few paragraphs he would send me another email. And that went on for like a day or two. And by the end of those 2 days, he was a bit grumpy. And then a day passed, and then he came back and he said, you know, it was well done. And he gave me an accuracy rating of 95%, which you, for Elon, you gotta, that's really good. And so, you know, he kind of quibbled with like three things in the book. Two of them were people's opinions of him. So I was kind of like, this isn't sort of a fact. This is what this person thinks. And then, and the other one was that, you know, that he takes a road trip with his brother Kimball at one point from the East Coast to the West Coast when they're kids. And Kimball had told me that he paid for the car, their crappy car, with like a summer job he'd had, and Elon was like, no, I bought the car with my summer job. So that was the only thing.
It was a brother feud.
Yeah, that was the only thing he disputed. Then when the book finally like reached other people, and those dirty journalists started writing, pulling out like all the juicy quotes and stuff, I mean, he kind of reacted to that again. But, you know, I think it's kind of natural if somebody digs into your life for 3 years. And
yeah. And when you were interviewing him, I mean, is he kind of an authentic, transparent person? I know I've been on a lot of calls, earning calls with Tesla, and interviewed him myself a few times, and it's kind of hard to tell what is authentic and what is kind of the vortex of Elon Musk, like charm and intelligence. So it's hard to tell if, you know, you're being manipulated or if this is the authentic, not necessarily manipulated in a bad way, but, you know, is this the authentic Musk that I'm getting?
I'm not even sure he knows sometimes, you know. it goes kind of a couple different ways, because most of the CEOs that I interview, I mean, if you ask them a straightforward question, you know, you get like a real answer 1 out of 10 times. I mean, everything is kind of by the playbook. Elon, you can ask him anything and you will get like an actual answer, and he can't even help himself from answering questions he should not be answering, you know. So, and he'll also answer them in this really verbose kind of way. So that reporters love that part. But then, I mean, there was a time we were having dinner, and, you know, he's telling me about why it makes sense to have a colony on Mars and how we're going to do it, and I'd interviewed all these other people beforehand that had sort of given me some ammunition about, like, why this can't happen or why he hasn't thought it all the way through, and then he's giving you kind of the Elon sermon about why we need to go to Mars and why this would work. And you can't really go toe-to-toe with him in physics at all. And so you sort of get as far as you can. And then, you know, he does kind of overwhelm you. And I kept being like, do you really believe it? You know, you seem so... You would be like, what about the habitats, you know? And he goes, that's fine. Those will be easy, you know? And it was like, and you're like, will it? Are you sure? And he's like, yeah, that's fine. That's not even a problem. And he says it so confidently. You're like, okay, I mean, you do build stuff like this. Maybe you, I'm sure you know better than I do. So I don't know, you know? And then sometimes I feel like Elon, like with the Hyperloop, I mean, I was in this whole journey. He told me about the Hyperloop before he ever announced this thing. It's this crazy fast monorail, essentially, that he wants to build. And, you know, when he first told me about it, he said, this is basically like a thought experiment. And you know, I just think the California high-speed train is a horrendous thing for the state. I want to put out a different idea that maybe will stop this horrible thing from being built. And then he announces the Hyperloop, and the entire world goes nuts because, like, half the people think he's crazy, and then half the people are like, this is Elon, this is great, let's build this thing. And then he totally sees everybody reacting, and then he flipped in, like, 24 hours because I was on the phone with him the day before, and he said, I'm not going to build this. And then the next day, he's like, I think I might build this, you know? And then so I think he kind of, like, falls for his own thing sometimes, too. Yeah.
He drinks his own Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense.
I mean, and it comes from, like, sort of a good place. I think it's, like, genuine excitement. Yeah. But you don't know, you still don't know if it's real or not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like you think you started the first chapter was, like, am I insane or?
Yeah. Do you think I'm insane?
I mean, do you think he's insane?
I mean, I don't think he's, like, clinically insane. I think he's, I think some people could look at him and consider his priorities or what he's sort of determined as his life's goal, creating a colony on Mars, and how he's going to do it, which is by working, you know, ungodly hours and being rough to people on along the way if that requires it. I mean, I think for some people that sort of lifestyle and decision would be insane. I don't think he's insane. I think he's like very rational and like ultra rational and logical.
Yeah. And he's talked a lot recently about the dangers of AI. You know, like what's going on there? Like, do you have insight into why he's really hot on this topic?
I don't think I have any fantastic insight. I mean, it was funny because over the very first dinner we had, he never has any small talk at all. So he came in. I was waiting at the table, and then he came in and sat down, and I was like, hi, Elon, how's it going? And he's, like, coming and sitting down, and he goes, you know, I mean, I'm just so afraid that artificial intelligence is going to destroy mankind, you know, and that was, like, that's, like, as he sat down, and I was kind of fumbling around trying to find my tape recorder. I didn't know things were going to start quite that quickly, and that was, like, 2012, and he's like, you know, I'm really good friends with Larry Page. I'm just really afraid that Larry's going to kill us all, and this is kind of tearing me apart. And you know, it's not because Larry's a bad guy. It's because he's kind of, like, too good of a guy, and he's naive about all this stuff. And then it just built from there. I mean, it was really funny. And then I talked to Tallulah Riley, his wife at the time, and she was telling me, this is like their pillow talk when they're like talking about AI. Just like, we're both really worried about it, and this is what we talk about at night. And I thought that's Elon's. Like, who else can you talk about these things with? And you know, over the course of like the last 2 or 3 years, it just seems to have gotten more and more dramatic. I guess today or yesterday they put out this paper calling for a ban on basically AI weapons, and so this is definitely top of mind for him. I think it's creating some tension with him and Larry because Google always gets like fingered as the most obvious candidate for, you know, evil in this scenario.
Yeah. Do you think he has more, you know, ideas and companies kind of up his sleeve with all these things going on? I mean, I guess he has the satellite project he's working on.
He does have some. I just don't know if he'll ever... Well, ever is a long time. I don't know if he'll get to them anytime soon. I mean, we're talking one time. He was talking about an electric jet that he wants to make, which sounds wonderful because instead of having airports on the edge of cities because they're so loud and you need the runway for them to take off, he wants to make it so that you could fly right into Manhattan. And so you would have this vertical liftoff, all-electric jet that was totally quiet and then just pop in for your meetings and pop out. And apparently, like, he and Sergey Brin and Larry Page at Google they've come up with some strategy where they could have something that was always orbiting the Earth, like a fueling station, and these jets could pop up and refuel and pop back down. And
wow.
And he, he's told me he plans to make this, so.
Wow. That'd be excellent. Charged by Tesla
superchargers? A lot of batteries for that one, yeah.
Nice. And his legacy is creating companies. You know, a lot of these entrepreneurs, like Peter Thiel, his former PayPal.
Fund them.
Yeah. End up moving into funding companies or, you know, Gates moving into philanthropy. But it seems like Elon Musk really wants to create these entities.
I think he does. Elon still has a lot to prove. But, I mean, the funniest thing since the books come out, and I've done all these interviews, is that, like, he doesn't get any credit for PayPal. You know you've done a lot in your life when, like, people don't even mention that you built PayPal. You know, then it's like, oh, that, well, I mean, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, in his first company, he sold for $300 million, and nobody ever talks about that. So, yeah, he seems, you know, you got to, we don't know where these things will end up. He's got a lot to prove, but you got to give him credit for, at 44, having done this much is pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, we were talking a little bit about PayPal. I mean, did you have to go back deep to get into those stories, you know, since that was, you know, a while ago? You can kind of more access SpaceX and Tesla and Solar City nowadays, but PayPal is kind of, you're going back into the history of the .com.
Yeah, the, I mean, some of that reporting was maybe more difficult, but it was really fun too. I mean, it's so, it's a really interesting process reporting a book, because you see, like, so the company before PayPal was called X.com. It kind of morphed into PayPal, and there were four founders of the company. And I mean, each one of the four had, like, a different sort of opinion on exactly what had happened. It's just, it's a really funny process to see that, like, the four people in the room all saw the situation completely differently. And Tesla's sort of the same way as well with Martin Eberhard and Elon. I mean, they just will never see eye to eye on what happened with that company. And so that was the most fun part about, like, the PayPal and the Zip2. Well, the Zip2 years were also really funny, because you see young Elon trying to, he just, like, gets thrown into Silicon Valley and is trying to make this company from scratch, and he's sleeping in a beanbag next to the desk, and he asks, you know, these, like, 22-year-old kids to kick him when they come in so he'll get back to work. And this, like, actually happens all the time. And Elon would just, he was, like, a self-taught coder, and he would just code all the time, and was just totally convinced that's kind of how he would win. And then there's this one hilarious part where they, he and his brother always had, like, a little bit more marketing savvy than Elon, although Elon does okay today. But so they have a website, but they would go to the investors, and they were trying to, like, convey how impressive their website is, even though it hardly worked at all. And so instead of having, like, they weren't really doing laptops back then, so they built this, like, massive computer. It was way bigger than it needed to be. It had, like, basically, like, a fake case around it. And when the investors would come, they would come in and they would roll it in and, like, push it. It was so hard to bring in the room. And it was all, like, this total act to make this thing seem important. Yeah. And then Elon told all the employees, like, anytime the VCs came in, everybody had to pick up the phone and just act like you were talking to someone. And I mean, so some of these, like, stories when he was a really young guy are funny.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that, you know, he made this money in the dot-com era and then funneled it back into these super difficult problems. And that's one reason why, you know, he stands out among Silicon Valley is, you know, there's so many people working on mobile photo sharing apps and all these different things, kind of easy money in Silicon Valley. And, you know, not to say that PayPal was easy, but he used, you know, the easier returns in the internet to kind of fund this grand infrastructure expansion plan.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other reason I wanted to do the book. I guess I'd grown pretty cynical about Silicon Valley. Maybe I've been doing this too long. Things have gone so consumery and entertainment focused, and I'd always gravitated towards semiconductor companies and all the companies that made, like, the PCs and servers and networking equipment, and you know, a ton of that's gone now. And so to me, Elon was kind of a throwback, and I thought, you know, maybe be, like, a bit of an inspiration for other people to sort of give this kind of stuff a try. You have to give him credit at this point for, like, the amount of jobs he's created, and he's got factories in California and Texas and New York and Nevada. I mean, the, you know, and SpaceX is like the only aerospace company to make all of its stuff in the United States. We still buy Russian engines to send up our spy satellites, which I think is nuts. I think he's a nice throwback at this time, and that's what kind of really drew me in.
Yeah. All right, I'm just going to ask you one more, and I think we're going to go to audience questions. But I asked you briefly about the satellite project, but I think you've reported that out a little bit. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so if you guys don't know, Elon wants to build a space internet, and this would be, you would essentially surround the Earth with 2,000 or 3,000 small satellites. There's like a lot of, about half the world's population can't get fiber cables either because it's too expensive or impractical to lay them down. And so these satellites would be close enough to Earth to give people sort of fiber optic speed. So on one hand, it's kind of like a philanthropic type thing, although I think they would have to pay for this. But and then on the other hand, it would be sort of like a backup for the entire internet. If there was a failure with a big fiber line between Europe and North America, this could handle some of that traffic. And then Elon has like a third reason for it, which other physicists aren't quite convinced of. He says that because light travels faster in space, that you could use the space internet as like a backhaul network for huge amounts of traffic between, say, North America and Europe, and that he would make a ton of money as essentially like the world's ISP. There's one other company that sort of has a head start on this project that looks like they'll get there before Elon does. And then Elon also, he wants there to be internet on Mars when we get there. So this is a first step toward that.
Excellent. All right, I think we're ready for audience Q&A. Okay, cool.
Our thanks to Ashley Vance and Katie Fehrenbacher on Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the quest for the fantastic future. We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. We now open the floor for questions. Keep your questions short. If you have a question, please raise your hand, and I will walk to you, and we are recording.
Yes, now, you've written about a man who's sort of halfway through his life. In your mind, are you on board 25 years from now to write the sequel?
It's pretty funny, because Elon gave me such a hard time about doing the book initially, and then we were in one of our latter interviews, he goes, "We're going to have to talk about a sequel, you know?" And I was like, "Oh, man, come on. You made it so hard at the beginning." I don't know. I can't tell if I'm like permanently in the Elon Musk business or not. So I feel like there definitely has to be sort of like another chapter in kind of 10 years if we see the mainstream Tesla car come out, or SpaceX gets to reusable rockets, or certainly in 10 years, according to Elon's calendar, we'll be in Mars, but he tends to be a little optimistic on these things. But yeah, I mean, I feel like it has to get updated. The tricky thing was, I knew I was doing a book on this guy whose life was in progress. It was just that I knew somebody was going to do it, and I wanted it to be me, and so you had to kind of pick a line in the sand and just go. Yeah.
Hi, I have a question. So we talked about Elon Musk, and essentially he had amazing successes, incredible successes, but he has a lot of things going for him in terms of his family. He has a lot of privileges in terms of physical body. He's very healthy. You say that he was built like a tank. And in terms of, especially his mind is very sharp, very logical. He has this eidetic memory going for him. So what do you find inspiring about him that is relatable to people that is less gifted?
Yeah, well, no, I think it's a fair question. And then a lot of people are always like, can I be like Elon Musk? And I mean, it's like, I kind of don't know if you want to be, especially with the childhood stuff. The thing that I took away, I guess, was that, and again, I don't think I would do this on kind of the full Elon level, but, you know, he has, like, decided what one or two or three things are the most important to him, sort of like, that he wants to accomplish in his life. I mean, he's so focused about picking these things, and then he devotes, you know, so much of like his soul to trying to accomplish those. And I guess I came away, it definitely made me reevaluate, especially from like a work standpoint, you know, stop doing kind of like the trivial things and focus on the big things and put all of your energy into them even more than you were before, sort of like doing the book. I mean, it kind of carried me through, and I think it's made me a little more like ruthless at my day job about the things, you know, making better decisions about the things that I pick that I want to do. And I sort of think like on that level, he can be a model for anyone.
Ashley, you spoke in the beginning about some of the difficulties in the first three interviews, in particular that you used the metaphor that you felt like he could turn the faucet off at any time and to kind of keep the water running, so to speak. What was it for you on a creative process level as a writer? Did you feel like you were feeding some sort of metaphorical meter to keep that water flowing, so to speak, and what was that like?
Well, there was a lot of pressure at the beginning. I did this first interview with them, and it went well, and then I pretty much would do the same thing every single time, which is the second the interview ended, I would usually get him to sort of commit to doing another one at the very end, and then I would walk out the door, and I would call his assistant on the phone and schedule another meeting, and I sort of just kept feeling like it was a momentum thing. You just kind of keep things moving forward as much as you can, and you know, I just didn't know. I honestly fully expected I was going to get an email from Elon or his assistant at any day and just say, you know what, that's enough. Because I ultimately, he was like very, very generous with his time. Once he committed, there was like a point where I sort of felt like I was abusing things, you know, just I still wanted to know more, and he would always say yes. And you know, he would come to these meetings just looking like it's like a chewed up piece of meat. I mean, he's like, you could tell he hadn't slept in days. He would have these huge bags under his eyes, and he would still sit there and talk to me for 3 or 4 hours and shut down the restaurant. And then I would get home. I would go home, and I'm like, where are you going? He goes, oh, I'm going to go back to the plane and fly to Los Angeles. And this is at like midnight or 1 a.m. So, yeah, I don't know. The entire book writing process I found was all about, you just can't get discouraged, and wherever you find momentum, you have to like go with that. Every time you have a good interview, you just focus on that, build on that, and it was the same with Elon.
Thanks for sharing, Ashley. I'm wondering whether you have any insight into how he deals with his 5 kids.
Yeah.
Sons, right?
They are. They're all sons, twins and triplets. I think the older set is like 11-ish now. Yeah, well, I have some insight. I mean, they live completely unconventional lives. He is divorced from his first wife, so they share custody with the kids. They were all hers and his. And he has them about 4 days a week. He's got like a team of nannies, at least 2, sometimes 3. You know, they are probably the only kids on the face of the planet that get bored going to the rocket factory because they have to go on like Sunday and watch their dad work and they just kind of lay on the floor. I was interviewing one time, and it was Friday, and it was about 7 o'clock at night, and they had a camping trip planned in Washington State. And you know, I mean, it was already getting dark, and you can't really just roll into a camping site. And Elon was totally unfazed by this. The interview ended at like 8. He flew his jet to Washington, had a couple SUVs with guards pick him and his kids up, took him to the camping site where they had already like laid everything out, and he just went to bed, you know. And another time he came and he sat down for dinner, and he said, yeah, I just got back from Monaco. I took the boys. We went to see the F1 races, and I was like, oh, how was that? He goes, oh, well, you know, we were sitting with the prince and the princess, and the boys really got a kick out of that. And so, I mean, I think they live kind of an extraordinary life. Everyone I've ever talked to said that he was a good dad and that he has sort of, like, lavished attention on them. I talked to a couple of people who've been on this like annual camping trip all the time, Burning Man, things like that. I mean, you know, I think he's really good with his kids.
Thanks, Ashley. It's really fascinating. I'm really curious how you ended with him. How did you know you had enough for how did that get to the ending point to start writing?
Well, yeah, it was sort of a function of a couple things. One is I was already, because Elon participated so late in the process, I was very late on delivering my book. And so I had like this ticking, I'd missed a bunch of deadlines, because it was really hard. I had essentially like the main character, it was like I was ready to sit down and start writing the book, and that was like almost to the day when Elon called. So then you have all this reporting you do, and then also when Elon, when he agreed to do the interviews, he also gave me access to all the company executives, which he had not been doing beforehand. So then I have to go interview all these people that have been there forever, and so you just, I mean, it was like this treasure trove of material. So, you know, like at some point, I mean, I could have probably just kept going forever. At some point, you just have to sort of be like, look, this has to get done, and I'm going to pick the moment. The nice part was at the very beginning when I started, you know, Elon, as far as I know, and I'm not 100%, I'm pretty sure on this, I think he was going to hire a ghostwriter to like compete with me and try to get a book out before I did. So I was like in a big race. And then Elon wanted to write his own book. And I never knew if he was going to write an autobiography or what it was. And so it was the same kind of thing as with the interviews. I was like, I got to get this thing out, and so eventually you have to stop. And then at the very end, Elon's like, oh, I am doing my own book. It's going to be a treatise on why we should go to Mars. And I'm like, what? You could have done that all this time. I would never have been worried about that, you know. But I totally thought he was going to try to beat me to market, yeah, with his own life.
Thanks for sharing all these things, Ashley. My question is, if you were having the book been out for a while, what are some things that maybe if you were to revise or questions that you were further, areas of his life that you would further dig into, what would those be?
That's a really good question. There's nothing I felt like I totally regret. It's been pretty funny because, like, from the professional reviews, like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal and the FT, they were all completely divided. One was like, oh, I was too nice to Elon. One was like, oh, he was really mean to Elon. And then the other one was like, oh, he's right in the middle. And then, you know, on Amazon, I shouldn't read the reviews, but I do read some of them. And then, you know, you see there's definitely like some, there's a lot, I just don't know how to read it. There's a lot of people who sort of thought that I was ultimately kind of too easy on him. It was weird because I would not have done the book if I was not interested in what Tesla and SpaceX were doing to begin with. And then when you go do the reporting, you know, it's really not just Elon. It's what all these people have accomplished over the course of so many years. It's fantastic. And so, you know, I think there was like a genuine enthusiasm from me that sort of gets in to the book. And I don't regret that at all. And then ultimately, you know, I felt like I really tried to tell the truth where Elon was concerned, and so I don't know. I don't have any huge regrets. I wish, obviously, like the father thing, I kind of desperately want to get to the very bottom of that, but I don't know if I ever will.
Yes, I just have a question about whether Elon is like competitive, and if there are any young Turks coming up through the ranks that have him clocking his six. Well, you know, if he's really like, because there's Jason Tetrick of Hampton Creek, who's kind of making this big campaign about changing the whole food system. So I'm just wondering if he's like that.
Elon is definitely competitive in an unhealthy way. I've never heard him sort of really, the people he's usually angry at are like the entrenched competitors in the automotive industry and aerospace and the congressmen that are sort of giving him a hard time at any moment. I don't think he really has much respect for sort of like this latest, and not to like wholesale categorize everyone, but you know, kind of where Silicon Valley is right now, social networks, things like that. I don't think they impress Elon, and I think he would be, in fact, kind of like dismissive of like a Mark Zuckerberg, you know. But he's like brutal to compete against, but it's mostly these people in the industries where he's already playing.
In his style of management, does he mentor folks inside the organization to move up? Thank you.
That's a good question. That's a really good question. You know, there's people who have been there. Yeah, I would say he does. At both SpaceX and Tesla, the EVPs, the top rung of other executives, in most cases, they have been there a long time, and they are willing to sort of subjugate their ego in order for Elon to do his thing. And so I don't know if they're really – he's definitely not grooming them or anything, but it's a very functional relationship, and they've gotten to take on more and more. Gwynne Shotwell is the president of SpaceX. You know, she started down as, like, the head of sales at the very beginning and has worked her way up and become the president. She, like, runs SpaceX day to day. I mean, she's incredible. And then you see these other instances where, you know, if something's going wrong at Tesla, I mean, he's had – these sort of life or death moments where, you know, all the middle managers who were not performing, they're out. And the young people, he's like, this is your chance, go. And you either sink or swim. So I don't know if that counts as career development, but you know, certainly if you do well at that point, you have a chance to move up.
Okay, here's our final question. As you know, Bill Gates made a tremendous amount of money in his lifetime, and now he's spending the last years of his life giving it all away. Can you imagine Elon Musk getting to this point in life, and how far up would you think it might be?
I think he's like signed the billionaire's pledge thing, but you know, it's very funny for Elon, right? So Jeff Bezos has a rocket company, which essentially competes with SpaceX, although they seem to be kind of years behind. But, you know, Jeff never had to make a money-making rocket company. He's been funding this thing for 10 or 12 years. He's got billions upon billions of dollars. When Elon started these other companies, he didn't have the – I mean, he had a couple hundred million, but it was enough to get these companies off the ground. He didn't have the luxury of just being able to do whatever he wanted. So SpaceX actually has had to make a profit. They've had to become a commercial operation. Elon constantly just takes whatever money these companies make and just puts it right back into a new risk. And so, you know, he's all of his money, almost all, like 99% of his money outside of like a couple restaurants and really small amounts in startups is tied up in his companies. And so he's like not liquid at all. And I think Elon sees Mars as his philanthropy for the human species. I think that's where all the billions will go. If he gets to Mars and he still has a bunch of money left over, he might send some back.
Okay. On behalf of the Commonwealth Club in Northern California, our audience, we'd like to thank Ashley Vance and Katie Fehrenbacher for speaking to us about Elon Musk. This is a program of the Commonwealth Club in California. Thank you very much.
Thank you.